This is part three of my chat with Jason Tuckwell. You can find parts one and two on my website. That's bendenham.com under the podcast section.
If we accept things like fitness has increased and our body mass has increased because of certain things we consume, like meat, or that the oxygenation event precipitated multicellular bodies because more energy became available, maybe our problem is that we're just trying to demarcate psychedelics in this particular way because we think there are consequences there that are a special case. Maybe they're just not.
Right, yeah. No, absolutely. I think this is the thing, right? I think this becomes a really useful, you know, it's why, you know, I'm really interested in putting psychedelics into a biological context, right? Because I think we can invent all of these different arguments about what is so special about our relationship to them. But I think if we understand a little bit more about how, you know, molecules operate, you know, between organisms, then I think we're better served to appreciate what I think is, and I think this comes back to what I think is like you know, one of the most common psychedelic insights is that we are fundamentally connected to the rest of life, right? Yeah. This is like something that people, you know, is constantly occurring to people through the psychedelic experience, that a profound relationship to the rest of life on the planet, you know. Yes. So then it becomes interesting for me to think about how are we related. Mm. Like what kinds of ways are we related? Mm. And I think we're certainly related through, I mean, actually, you know, this is something that is like a really recurrent theme throughout evolution, right? Is that you share an intimate connection to what you eat, right? Yes. That you are always in intimate relation to what you eat, right? Mm. So the chloroplast that exists in plants, right? This is the result of one bacteria eating a photosynthetic bacteria, getting indigestion, and those chloroplasts hanging around and living inside the cell of a bacteria, right? So that then produces the symbiotic event that then leads to the chloroplasts in plants, and you have throughout, you know, and then you have, say, the example of the leaf cutter ants that cultivate a particular fungus. Mm. Right, so you know, there's these really intimate relationships between species that come up once when you look at, you know, who's eating what. Mm. You know, and you know, I think then, you know, if you put our ingestion of certain plants into those terms, then yeah, it kind of makes sense that we, you know, that there will be these, there'll be all sorts of intimacies and insights that come out of, you know, those kinds of relationships.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And there are, it's difficult, really. I mean, if you sort of try and reflect on just that event that you're talking about,
The chloroplast. Yeah.
I mean, it's a very... There are a lot of really new sorts of problems that just emerge from that particular thing. If you try and think it through, you know, we have this reductive model that consumption is reducible to energy. It doesn't matter what you eat, it just turns it into energy and whatever. And so, therefore, we have this original level at which we can make sense of that exchange. How you get from that to a situation where this consumptive event, which has been going on and on and on for innumerable repetitions, and for some reason it deviates in such a way that the autonomy of one being remains in the middle of one, event one, two, then it becomes reproducible in the next species. That is not... In the tools, conceptual tools that we have, and we then go on to say that it's reducible, they are not capable of accounting for either of those events. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not talking about outlier events.
Mm. No, these are pretty important. Like,
this is something that goes on.
And yeah, sure.
Then not only gets repeated, it gets built upon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you have an assembly of multicellular things, and then the cells become more complicated and they ingest and reproduce specific differences of other kinds. And then that goes on and on and on until you get to us, which is this bewilderingly complicated assemblage of different things. And this is the thing that really, I think a lot of our gaps in our way to try and think these things causally and whatever, significant gaps are there in thinking that through.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not easy.
No, but like you say, it is really, it's something that happens again and again. And actually the example of the chloroplast and like the example of mitochondria, like there's some people who argue that that happened once and only once, mm-hmm. right? Yep. And that the evidence would seem to suggest that yes. mitochondria happened once.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have all sorts of philosophical debates about, you know, why was there only one symbiotic event that led to mitochondria. Mm. But when it comes to chloroplasts and in plants, this has happened hundreds of times, and in all sorts of different lineages. So clearly, this combination of like a photosynthesizing bacteria or algae,
yes,
like that gets incorporated then into the cells of another organism.
Yep.
There's something that those cells they have. There's a compatibility there between those yeah, elements.
Absolutely, you know? And I understand. And I mean, no doubt there are these sorts of. And we talked before about the importance of not assuming homogeneity in processes, and that's an obvious corollary of that principle, that it will happen like that. But it's also the case that there are other instances of those singular events, if I understand this correctly, that seem to have occurred in a definitive way and then they spread through hereditary.
Yeah.
But then there are emergent patterns or there are horizontal affiliations that happen in certain ways and then they, for some reason, find their way into the original pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Our difficulty is, and I think, or what we have to attend to, I think, is we've got to come up with, we have to take them seriously. Mm. We have to think them through in that way rather than trying to reduce them to a general principle.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think actually that it is interesting to think about those singular, what have been described as singular events. Because then you maybe can open up a perspective on certain aspects of evolution that you know you otherwise wouldn't be able to touch on. One of the explanations for the evolution of mitochondria as a signal event would be that once you produce a cell that suddenly has this capacity to generate energy in the way that the mitochondria does for our cells, that you have completely changed the game, right? Mm. You've changed the game in such a radical way that then those cells are likely to be incredibly successful, spread rapidly, and occupy all of the niches that may have been available for that first stage to be able to happen again, right? So you won't get another endosymbiotic event that incorporates the mitochondria because all of those niches are already occupied by cells that contain mitochondria.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is an argument that Jonathan Weiner makes in relation to these hook-billed finches. So right. There's these hook-billed finches that have the ability to crack open pine nuts because they have extra leverage because their bill is kind of hooked.
Yes.
And he basically says that we're now in a situation where it's impossible for another hook-billed finch to evolve. Right. Because you've already got a finch that's in that niche, you know, cracking open those pine nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no energetic imperative for a new finch to come in and, you know, because the niche is already occupied.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So then I think you in some ways this is where you go into that when we're talking about autopoiesis and the emergence of you know, like the deviation, you know, that the whole, you know, it kind of goes back to the point, right, where the whole system deviates.
Yes.
Right? It's not just the organism that deviates, but the whole system deviates on, across, you know, into some other state.
Yeah, and no doubt what we need to be able to do, talking about our capacity for perspectivism or consciousness of different levels, is we need this sort of flexibility in our epistemological models. So no doubt that there's an intelligibility or a causal structure that operates in a general way, and then there are ones that operate in local ways, and they probably don't have the same underlying principles. And I think as a sort of conceptual model for that, something like category theory in mathematics is a really promising way to think through that, which fundamentally, well, it arises out of the fundamental collapse of there being any pure logical continuous foundation for all mathematical structures. Mm-hmm. So it emerges as a way to cope with that. And the way that it does that is that it just says that laws are local.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have, tellingly, different sorts of mediating functional processes that connect the laws of one system to another.
Mm.
That seems to me to be probably, for its extraordinary abstraction, as good a sort of model of, veracity for the natural that we've come up with so far.
Yeah. Well, actually, it brings me back to William James, because I think he's got this often cited quotation in from the Varieties of Religious Experience, where he's talking about how our normal waking everyday consciousness is just but one type of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
separated from it by the filmiest of screens are all these other different types of consciousness, right?
Yes.
That if we apply the requisite stimulus, we are available to us, and that somewhere have their field of application. He articulates this view of consciousness that is very much very often cited in relation to psychedelics, because it basically, he's basically saying the mystical experience is important, and it's an important aspect precisely what we've been talking about, right? The incompleteness of knowledge, right?
Yes.
Like if we don't have an account for these types of experiences, then our knowledge is dramatically incomplete, right?
Yes.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways this ability to then think about the significance of those experiences, like what does it mean? What does it mean that we can ingest a substance and go floating off into different parts of the universe and have all sorts of crazy experiences, and I think, this kind of comes back to pragmatism, what do we do with this, and I'm trying to draw a relationship back to this thing in mathematics of local laws, right?
Yeah.
How do we make sense of these experiences? And for William James, he would say, from his kind of pragmatic perspective, he would say that we should judge the truth of these experiences based on the kind of work that they produce, right? Their fruits, right? Mm. So if you take a psychedelic and you think you're Jesus and you go around sprouting some crazy shit and it becomes a kind of pathology for you as a person, then that is not a true insight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, if you take a psychedelic and it leads you to maybe work for the conservation of, the Amazon or whatever, right? Whatever values you want to put on these kinds of questions. Like if it leads you to a more ethical way of being and living in the world, then there's truth in that.
Yeah. And look, I mean,
I would perhaps go so far as to say that I don't think that the person who thinks that their Jesus is any less crazy in the sense or regard, if what we think that would imply is somebody who's trying to communicate the fact that they feel like they've attained a superior level of consciousness to what they previously had and use the signifier of Jesus as the thing that they reach for because that's what they know. And I guess if this obviously raises the point of the of a certain affinity between psychedelic experience and artistic process, which you suggested at first, I guess it's in this sense, in the sense in which that we've had this idea for a long time that the importance of art and maybe psychedelic experience like this is that it allows us to envisage a new future. And whether that's the sort of version of, you know, Foucault's, you know, sort of postulating of this sort of post-humanity and this, you know, extraordinary, when you think about it, this image at the end of, you know, the order of things with the human face that's washing away in the sand, you know, that sounds pretty psychedelic, right? Personally, this sort of dissolution, growth through dissolution of, and I guess, in a way, you know, there's something about evolution that's about that. It's, you know, a certain form is left behind and something else comes along. And if you believe in evolution, obviously we're not the end unless we manage to successfully wipe ourselves out and everything else is possible. fortunately, life is very resilient.
Yeah,
so
that's right. The bacteria are going to keep doing that thing, I would think.
We'll have to invent some pretty more impressive weapons if we're going to wipe them out. But there is a question about that. And if it's complete rubbish that, you know, psychedelics and had no role in elevating human consciousness and changing it, there's probably a clearer case that art did. If you think about art in terms of technology and technique, and let's just take the uncontroversial one of language. Once that happens, it becomes this extraordinary vector to change our environment.
Yeah. Well, this is precisely the thing where I think that, you know, those arguments about psychedelics and human evolution are interesting because, you know, if we look at the use of psychedelics in pre-Columbian cultures in the Americas, art is right there, right? These are two things that are used together, you know, like they're obviously, like in the ceremony, song is crucial, right? Singing is a crucial part of that, and art is a means, like art through song particularly is a means to communicate through to a broader network of organisms. So, you know, so I think I think if you think about a kind of synergistic maybe relationship between, you know, all of those things, once again, you know, like the, you know, like how these things are connected and related, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this obviously relates to the way that you've tried to qualify that psychedelic experience du jour is not the point. There's a great difference between taking ayahuasca in a situation in which it's embedded within a particular culture and it serves particular functions and it's regulated by a discipline, and what happened in the countercultural movement and why that didn't end up in social utopia.
Yeah.
I mean, they're different drugs. I mean, ayahuasca was around at that time and a lot of those hippies were going down and they were taking the same drug, and I mean, it was a lot of LSD and whatever as well, as far as I understand, and you know, mushrooms as well. But context is crucial.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the way that we're talking about evolutionarily, it's always been crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think this is the thing as well.
Not in an agar dish.
Precisely. Yeah. It's not raining. It's not raining nutrients down on us. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, no, but I think this is kind of the aspect of psychedelics that is so interesting, is that there is this really powerful feedback loop between the meaning that we make of them, their role in the culture, and then how they are incorporated into that culture and the sense that we continue to make of them. So, you know, if we say, for example, Michael Pollan, you know, has written this book on psychedelics, and you know, he points out in this talk that there is this really strong relationship between the counterculture and Eastern mysticism, mm-hmm. right? And you know, I think we all can appreciate that link, and I think it is really a huge part of psychedelics in the West, is understanding them through the frame of Eastern mysticism. And you know, like, so often when we take these, and I think that, you know, maybe this is kind of true of your own interest in psychedelics, we had some relationship between a meditation practice and
absolutely when I was very young. Absolutely. And I mean, it also goes into these broader questions about Western imperialism, in the sense that perhaps just cultural exchange in itself is psychedelic.
Yeah, right.
You know, and the way that you talk about we think about the famous examples in art, Picasso, fucking creates this genius moment by stealing African aesthetics,
right.
You just sort of say, and that this has a consciousness altering effect on people through an aesthetic mode. And you sort of start to think that, it's engagement with different, and I use the word culture here carefully, but trying to think through as well these broader questions that we've been thinking about embeddedness, whether it's in ecologies with different species or whether we're just talking about different human expressions of culture, that they cause transformation.
Yeah. Well, this, because I think this is that's another kind of classic effect of psychedelics, is that you come out of them with a completely new perspective on your life and your relationships. And I think that you can get similar perspectives learning another language or traveling and being immersed in another culture, right? Suddenly you see things, absolutely. You see the relativity of your everyday kind of perception.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up in suburbs in Australia and, not particularly highly culturally sophisticated, but, everybody has a basic knowledge about the Western canon and the sort of things that exist and that sort of broad stroke history of aesthetics and the way that it moves through the church and whatever. And then you go to Europe and you just go through those galleries and you just go through gallery after gallery after gallery of this progression of something, and you see something entirely different of those connections. And part of that is you process it for yourself. Yeah. You don't process the narrative about it. Yeah. You have the opportunity to form your own narrative. And I guess any sort of, that link between knowledge and exposure and those sort of the way that, in a phenomenological sense, that builds impressions. And I would say something more specific about that too, that and I think anybody who's an artist knows this, you don't come out of an education or an exposure of particular artworks without your eyes being different. Your perceptual mechanism is altered by the process. Yes. In the same way that your hands are altered after playing a piano for 10 years. Or being a surgeon and feeling what a flesh feels like in particular things when you cut. And any of those technical things, all testify to me to the fact that understanding our origins is not enough.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think it's precisely that feedback loop, right?
Yes.
We are changed. Like when we go into and when we have a powerful encounter with a work of art, we emerge from that encounter a different person in terms of how we perceive the world, right?
That's right. And that should be understood as a form of horizontal evolutionary pressure. So if through the history of art you get a particular increased sensitivity to color differentiations or something, or because you live in a particular environment, like the famous case of the Eskimos who can differentiate between, you know, 20 different types of snow or something like that, we don't know how, but somehow those sorts of encultured experiences make their way back into the next generation in the way that somehow the chloroplasts envelopment within another one somehow gets replicated in the next species. And to me, it's a mute argument in that sense of that sort of radical reductionism. Because wherever you draw the line, you have to account for it somewhere.
Yeah, there's always something that's kind of feeding back into the system in some way.
And if you keep going back all the way, then you're a theist, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't matter if your version of God is a machine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Deus ex machina is still a god.
Sure, yeah. Because, you know, I think it's precisely that level of feedback, which I think art and psychedelics have in common, right? Where if I go into a psychedelic experience with already, you know, certain ideas about what that can be, then they will very much shape what it is that I experience in that condition, right? And you know, this is where I think it's interesting that what you have, you know, what you were talking about before about variation becomes like a really important thing, because you know, I think a similar thing applies to the psychedelic experience, in that it's this dramatically open thing where it can go almost anywhere, right? It can, you know, quite literally in terms of our subjective experience, can go almost anywhere in the universe.
Yes.
Right? So then how do you put some useful constraints around that experience?
Absolutely. And you know, the conservative side of, I guess, the arguments around any drug use is certainly aimed at that. And that's a valid point, obviously, an importantly valid point to make, is that they can just become their own self-repeating structures, and which are not helpful, you know. And it's a point that Deleuze and Guattari make, I guess, very much in the midst of or post that sort of, I guess, when they're, you know, in A Thousand Plateaus, when they're considering the sort of why the 68 revolution failed, you know, and one of their sort of passing comment that they make there is that, you know, of course, drugs don't allow you to do anything productive, you know, like they're great at the time, but like, you know, like then they don't allow you to do anything. And in that sense, I guess, perhaps there's another sort of, there could be something instructive about the way that good art practice modulates creative differentiation by placing it within strict confines.
Yep.
And in the sense of practices, and particularly non-Western practices that have incorporated those elements and of where they perform, they seem to perform in a way that does increase a consciousness of interconnectedness between elements of the environment and the individuals who are in it. That's clearly what's lacking in those systems. Precisely. When you're a 20-year-old and you take a tab of acid and go to whatever. Like, look, I mean, it doesn't mean it can't happen. And I think for a lot of people, it does.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, absolutely, like, you know. Yeah. Like,
but also, what's lacking from that scenario, and you're like, I'm just thinking about my experiences with psychedelics as a 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. Like, what was lacking from that was a sense of how do I, like, what, I mean, I might have had those profound senses of connection and relation, but I had no framework in which to place that. You know, I had no, like, it's just this isolated thing that kind of sits out there, and it was a profound experience. It's marked in my brain as, you know, it's got the label on it, profound experience, but I didn't have a means to then think, okay, how does this relate to the culture that I find myself in? How does this help me to establish and maintain relations with the people around me? How does it help me to connect with plants and animals and, you know, all other organisms?
Yeah, you know? And look, I mean, I think you can withstand that. That's less traumatic as a 20-year-old, I think, because you're individuating. So you don't have as much of an established framework about you. So it's the dissolution that you experience there sort of as part of a, in my experience anyway, was sort of part of a percussive series of dissolutions. Sure. In which you're sort of de-implicating yourself from a sort of small familial unit or whatever, and you're sort of, you suddenly have to make your own choices and whatever, and the world is sort of a bit like that. That's why I have all credit to you, like, and I think you're very courageous, but as a 40-year-old I would be fucking terrified of taking the, because I have all these and I guess for me art making practice, and particularly for me in that way, it's become about philosophical interrogation and whatever, is sort of a very slow motion way of doing that.
Much safer. It's traceable. You know, and there's a thread. You know, there's a really clear thread that you can kind of follow into that exploration. And I think that's actually that to me is why I have been able to go to the Amazon and drink ayahuasca a couple times now, is because it is this limited thing, right? Yes. It's not about here, just go and experience the fucking universe and whatever comes up.
Absolutely.
You know? Like, it's actually like saying we're drinking this medicine. Yes. This is medicine.
Yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
is a healing practice. Mm-hmm. Those are the constraints that we're putting around it, the experience.
Yeah.
And once you put it into those constraints, then you, like, what it's, you know, it's the same thing that we think about in terms of art practice, right? As soon as you put some constraints around something, then there's all sorts of interesting work and possibilities that you can do to explore within those constraints. Because as soon as you say this substance is medicine and we're going to take it as medicine, then you're thinking about, well, what is medicine? What is that, right? Well, how can my Western concept of medicine expand to encompass this really powerful experience that I might have, you know, in a ceremony, right? And you know, so suddenly medicine isn't just a pill that you take and that has a certain effect on your body. Medicine is something that connects you with the physiological processes of your body that may even make those physiological processes come to conscious awareness where previously they are, you know, existing below the threshold of consciousness. And then you also realize that medicine is about healing not just my relationship to this heterogeneous configuration of cells that is my body, which is a fundamental thing, right?
Yes.
You know, like recognizing that, like, as we've been discussing, that my body is not a single thing.
Yes.
It's this heterogeneous thing that's made up of all these different cellular processes, and I need to be well with those to be well,
yes,
right? But then you kind of recognize that you know, medicine is also about healing my relationship to plants, animals, to my surroundings, to, you know, to the rest of the world, right? To my friends, to my family, you know.
Absolutely.
That all of that is medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And you know, I guess one of the primary psychedelic insights in that sense, or one of the things that they can help you to recognize, is that there's something we're also very limited by our conception of what our self is and what is other to us, if indeed we consider it at all. And it's possible not to.
Yep.
You know, this is one of the real difficulties with the concept of causality, as far as I'm concerned. And there are some people who are, and for very justifiable reasons, are very skeptical of thinking causally. But causality is very important to me, because I think it's one of the ways that we can try to follow through how we are connected. In a way that can be more specific. At its worst, a call for connection can just be a way of affirming our difference, sure. Our sort of singularity in relation to other things, unless it has specific details or particulars. Yeah. And thinking through the particulars and thinking their particular causal relationships, I think, just gives us a much better tools to try and get a clearer idea of what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where, like, the discipline of, like, plant medicine, you know, is really that, right? You know, because this is like, if you want to study these plants, you eat a really restricted diet, you go off into the jungle and you just ingest, you know, one or two foods and this one plant that you're studying at that time. And it's really about your, not just you know, human relationship to plant. It's about you specifically, your relationship under these very specific conditions to a particular plant and what it can do to your body.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? So, and I thought that your presentation of that was convincing, you know, in the way that, as a very specific practice of that essentially that what is going, if I understand what you were arguing for here clearly, was the way that that experience allows you to become conscious of certain sensitive mechanisms that we can't usually perceive, and that can be a way of acquiring quite seemingly ineffable knowledges about things that we would not normally have any causal way to try and think through what might be going on there. And I'm sure we have a long way to go about that, but that's a very intriguing idea.
Yeah.
That it could be at the level that allows you to attenuate to those sorts of chemical molecular exchanges.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think precisely, in some ways that's because we know from our experience of other senses that, as we were saying with art, right? Like, if you go in and have a powerful experience of art, you're changed. Your ability to perceive the world has changed in some way, right? So as soon as you, and in some ways that's an education of your sense, right? That's a way of teaching yourself to perceive the world in a different way. And the art has this kind of instructive kind of ability to show you a different way of perceiving the world, you know, and we know from all of the other senses as well, you know, like if you study perfumery, then you develop a more attuned sense of smell, you know, if you really study the differences between wines or whatever, you develop a more refined palate.
Absolutely.
You know, like so you know, it stands to reason that you could do the same thing for, like, your kind of chemical sensing by, you know, through certain practices, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Thanks for chatting.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you. It's
yeah.
Always wonderful. Yeah. It's unusual to have a microphone.
Yeah. But no, it's, you know, like, I think the other thing, you know, maybe just before we finish, like, the other thing that that I think, you know, is just worth mentioning is that the reason for doing this, you know, for recording this, because I think, you know, to me, one of my motivations in having these types of conversations is that there's this really important aspect of knowledge that is produced through conversation, right? You know,
absolutely.
And it goes to everything that we've been talking about, right? You know, that we can sit down and we both do. We can sit down and write our essays or whatever, our books.
Yep.
And that's important. But there are a whole set of other possibilities that crop up when you have two people
chatting
to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I can't agree more. You know, it's the model of joint authorship is not synthetic. Only.
Yeah.
If we take seriously what we've been talking about, there's an autopoetic element that emerges that is not reducible to some sort of combination of two.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a co-creation.
Correct. Yep.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
That was the final part of my conversation with Jason Tuckwell. If you're interested in future podcasts, go ahead and search for Ben Denham on YouTube and subscribe to my channel.